There isn't a lot that I can say about this film that you don't already know. It's a classic. There's no two ways about that. It's not only one of the greatest horror films of the 1980s, but one of the great horror films of all time. But if you're not old enough to have seen it in 1982 when it came out, you might be wondering why it was so scary to those of us who were. It was terrifying because the haunted house in the film wasn't a massive old mansion with a chilling backstory like The Haunting of Hill House, or even a place made menacing like The House on Haunted Hill. The Freeling House didn't look haunted. I mean, shouldn't be haunted. It was an ordinary house in an ordinary subdivision, just like the one that so many of us lived in during the 1980s. It was so scary because if their ordinary house could be haunted, then so could yours. Just like the ordinary houses that this film was inspired by, but we'll come back to that. In the film, we're introduced to the ordinary family that lives in this ordinary house in Cuesta Verde, California, a community that Stephen Freeling helped to plan. Stephen, played by Craig T. Nelson as the perfect suburban dad, had his choice of the new homes, and he lives there with his wife Diane, played by JoBeth Williams, their 16-year-old daughter Dana, played by Dominic Dunn, 8-year-old Robbie, played by Oliver Robbins, and 5-year-old Carol Ann, played by Heather O'Rourke. There's nothing extraordinary about their lives. They're just like the rest of us, with all the same ups and downs, school, work, taking care of the house, all that. But then late one night, Carol Ann starts inexplicably talking to the family's television set as it's displaying post-broadcast static, which is another of those things that you only understand if you grew up in the 80s or before. Television stations actually went off the air at the end of the day. That doesn't start to change until everyone had cable, which is a way that we used to watch TV before the internet and streaming. You know what? Never mind. Anyway, the next night, Carol Ann is back at it again. But this time, a ghostly white hand emerges from the screen, followed by a violent earthquake. As the family is shaken awake by the quake, Carol Ann eerily intones, "They're here." Soon, strange events began occurring in the house. A glass of milk spontaneously breaks, silverware bends, and furniture moves on its own. These phenomena initially seem benign, but soon grow sinister. During a severe thunderstorm, a backyard tree seemingly comes alive. A large limb crashes through the children's bedroom window, grabs Robbie, pulls him outside into the pouring rain. While the family rushes outside to rescue him, Carol Ann is pulled inside of a portal in the closet. After saving Robbie from the tree, the family frantically search for Carol Ann, only for her voice to call out from the television. As the terrified family tries to cope with their missing daughter, parapsychologist Martha Lesh comes to the house with team members Ryan and Marty to investigate. They determine there's a poltergeist intrusion involving multiple ghosts, but why would this house be haunted? Well, Stephen soon finds out from his boss that the Cuesta Verde development was built on a former cemetery. And while this seems disturbing, he's assured that the graves from the cemetery were moved to another location. Determined to find Carol Ann, the family send Dana and Robbie to safety, while Dr. Lee calls Tangina Behrens, a spiritual medium played perfectly by Zelda Rubinstein. Tangina explains the ghosts are lingering in different spheres of consciousness and are not at rest. They're attracted to Carol Ann's life force. Tangina also detects a dark presence she calls the Beast, who's restraining Carol Ann and preventing the other spirits from crossing over. The entrance to this dimension is in the children's bedroom closet. Naturally, right? But exits through the living room ceiling. It's decided that Diane, as her mother, will have the best chance of finding Carol Ann and bringing her to safety. So Diane, secured by a rope, passes through the portal, retrieves Carol Ann, and they drop through the ceiling to the living room floor, covered in ectoplasm. As they recover from the ordeal, Tangina makes a proclamation.
It has greatest fear.
This house is clean, and yet the haunting isn't over yet. After their ordeal, the family decides to move out of the house. Just before they leave, Stephen goes into his office while Dana is on a date, leaving Diane at home with Robbie and Carol Ann. The Beast attacks Diane and the children, trying to take Carol Ann back. Unseen forces drive Diane to the backyard in the pouring rain, where she stumbles into the flooded hole where the swimming pool was going to be. Skeletal corpses and coffins float up around her in the muddy hole, but she manages to get out and rush back into the house. She rescues the children, and they manage to escape just as more coffins and bodies erupt from the ground. Accompanied by his boss, Stephen arrives home to witness the mayhem and realizes the story behind the development was a lie. The subdivision was built on the cemetery, but the bodies were never moved. As Dana returns home, the Freelings jump into their car and they flee Cuesta Verde, just as the house implodes into a portal with stunned neighbors looking on. As a final note to the film, we see the Freelings check into a motel for the night, and Stephen quickly removes the television from their room. Poltergeist was released on June 4th, 1982, and became an immediate success. But as we've discussed in the past, it's been marked by both controversy and tragedy, resulting in the story of a curse that allegedly claimed the lives of cast members from the original film and the inevitable sequels that followed. The film was written and produced by Steven Spielberg, who was hot off the success of Close Encounters of the Third Kind at the time. And he wanted to make this film himself, but he couldn't. At the time, his next film, E.T., the Extraterrestrial, was in production, and his contract wouldn't allow him to direct another film, so he hired Tobe Hooper, director of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, to direct Poltergeist. Since Spielberg was constantly on the set during the making of Poltergeist, rumors circulated for years that he was the real director of the film, not Tobe Hooper. Over the last 40 years, though, actors and those who worked on the set have disputed this story, turning it into another Hollywood urban legend. But curses and accusations don't explain where the inspiration for the original story came from. For years, it's generally been accepted that the film is loosely based on a real-life poltergeist outbreak that occurred in 1958. But I'm not convinced this is the only inspiration. It turns out there was another haunting that made news just before Poltergeist was written that's even more terrifying and hits a lot closer to home. Welcome to American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. And welcome to the latest episode of Season 9, a season we call Based on a True Story. American Hauntings is written and performed by Troy Taylor, that's me, and is produced and co-hosted by Cody Beck. And this season, we're bringing you some of the scariest and most unsettling films about ghosts, demons, murder, and mayhem that have ever been shown on the silver screen. But you can't watch any of them and say, it's only a movie. Every episode of this season will offer the true story behind these terrifying films, which are usually even scarier than anything a movie studio can create. This is episode 12 of season 9, Poltergeist. Strange things were happening on Long Island in February 1958 when a family named Herman began to be assaulted by a series of inexplicable incidents caused by an unseen force that baffled police officers, scientists, and even parapsychologists from Duke University. It made its mark on America's supernatural history for that reason, and also because it was the first haunting ever shown on television, making it the very first paranormal reality show. It's also commonly believed to be the inspiration for the film Poltergeist, which has kept the story in the public eye for decades. But even after all these years, the mystery of what really happened remains unsolved. The incidents began on February 3rd at the home of the James Herman family in Seaford, New York. Their white and green ranch-style home was almost new, built in 1953. and had 3 bedrooms, a bathroom, a kitchen, a small dining room, a living room, and a basement that was divided between a utility room and a playroom for the kids. It was a typical home in a quiet, peaceful neighborhood with public parks and tree-lined streets. It was the last place you would expect anything out of the ordinary to occur. Well, it was a day like any other. Lucille Herman, a registered nurse, was there to welcome her children home from school and to prepare dinner. The children were Lucille, aged 13, and James, who was 12. Two ordinary kids with ordinary interests, but their ordinary lives were about to change. Moments after the kids walked into the kitchen, chaos erupted. Various bottles containing liquid located in different rooms of the house suddenly began to pop their caps and move around. No one saw the bottles move or explode, but they all heard the caps as they popped loose and the bottle's contents went spewing into the air. They later discovered an open bottle of bleach in the basement utility room, a bottle of liquid starch in the kitchen, bottles of shampoo and medicine in the bathroom, and a bottle of holy water was found open in the master bedroom. Each of the bottles had been sealed with twist-off metal or plastic caps. There was no easy way for them to have suddenly popped open. Well, puzzled, Mrs. Herman called her husband, who worked for Air France in New York City, and reported the strange popping sounds they'd heard. Mr. Herman was just as confused by the incident as his wife was, but since no one had been hurt, he decided there was no need for him to go home early. So as usual, Mr. Herman took the train to Long Island and arrived home just before 7 p.m. During his commute, he thought about his wife's earlier call and believed he'd solved the mystery. He was convinced that some sort of chemical reaction in the products had caused the bottle lids to pop open. It was just a coincidence that they'd all popped at the same time, he thought. But when he got home and examined the bottles and saw they all had screw-top lids, he wasn't sure what to think. Well, the excitement over the incident soon passed, and after 2 days went by with no new happenings, the bottles were mostly forgotten. But then on Thursday, again, about the time the Herman kids came home from school, another half dozen bottles popped their lids. A bottle of nail polish popped open, along with a bottle of rubbing alcohol, bottles of bleach, detergent, starch, and holy water. Again, it was almost a repeat performance from a few days before. The next night, it happened again, this time when Mr. Herman was home. He quickly had a suspect, his science-loving son, Jimmy, who he surmised had somehow rigged the bottles to pop open and scare his mother and sister. It wasn't a coincidence the bottles had popped open just when Jimmy got home from school. Well, James Herman chuckled about the prank, but didn't say anything. He wanted to catch his clever son in the act, so he kept an eye on him all weekend, sure that he'd catch him tampering with a bottle. On Sunday, it happened again. The tops popped off bottles of starch, turpentine, and holy water, but Mr. Herman had been watching. He was sure that Jimmy hadn't been anywhere near those bottles, so he couldn't figure out how he'd done it. So he decided to confront him. When Jimmy was in the bathroom brushing his teeth, Mr. Herman quietly slipped into the room and tried to get his son to take him into his confidence and explain how he'd done the trick. But Jimmy swore he was innocent. He hadn't done it, he told his father. And then, as if to prove it, the father and son were startled when bottles of medicine and shampoo suddenly slid across the bathroom sink counter and fell to the floor. Well, still skeptical, James searched the bathroom, looking for hidden wires or strings, but found nothing. Realizing that something unexplained was happening in the home, he did what anyone else might have done in the same situation in the late 1950s. He called the police. The call was placed to the Nassau County Police Department, and James spent the next several minutes trying to get Lieutenant E. Richardson to take him seriously. It didn't work. Well, not right away. Lieutenant Richardson first assumed the man was drunk or playing a practical joke, but eventually, swayed by the earnestness of the story, he decided that he'd listen. It didn't hurt that the Hermans had a good reputation in the community. And after listening to the story, he promised to send someone to investigate. A skeptical officer named James Hughes arrived at the Herman house and quickly changed his mind about the family being nuts. He hadn't been there long before several bottles in the bathroom popped their lids right in front of him. He quickly concluded that the Hermans did indeed need help. Well, the detective who was assigned to the case was Joseph Tozzi, a veteran investigator who wasn't sure what to think when he read Officer Hughes' report. He guessed the family was experiencing some natural phenomenon or was simply imagining things, or more likely, the popping bottles were getting a little help from someone in the family. On February 11th, Detective Tozzi arrived at the Herman house for an extended visit. He wanted to see what was allegedly happening for himself. He didn't have to wait long. Over the next few nights, the bottle of holy water and a perfume atomizer in Lucille's room popped open and spilled. There was no one in either room when the incidents occurred. On February 15th, the activity took another turn. As Jimmy and Lucille were watching television in the living room with a cousin, Martha Murda, a porcelain figure on a table next to the couch began to vibrate and then shot 2 feet through the air and loudly landed on the floor. But to the amazement of Jimmy, Lucille, and Martha, the figure wasn't broken. The Hermans now had made the decision to find someone to assist Detective Tozzi with the investigation, and they chose Father William McLeod of the Church of St. William the Abbot. The Hermans were devout Catholics and believed the church might be able to help in ways that ordinary methods could not. Father McLeod came to the house, prayed for the family, and blessed each of the rooms. But unfortunately, the strange force, which the family had dubbed Popper, wasn't ready to leave. Over the 2 weeks since the strange happenings had started, rumors of what was occurring at the Herman house had spread through the community. Eventually, the stories reached the newspapers, and radio and television reports followed. The story later appeared in both Time and Life magazines, too. If the family thought cleaning up spilled liquids and being startled by popping tops and moving objects were bad, all the public attention was worse. Each day, their house was surrounded by reporters, photographers, television crews, and curiosity seekers, while police officers and later other investigators came and went. Worse, though, were the letters and calls that began arriving every day. Many proposed logical solutions, while others told the Hermans that Martians had landed nearby, or that the problem in the house was the spirit of a long-dead Indian chief, or that the Russians were tunneling under Long Island to invade New York. The Hermans took it all in stride and tried to remain open-minded. They never turned away anyone who genuinely wanted to help, and they usually listened attentively to the calls and suggestions. Even those who shouted, "Repent!" into the telephone at midnight or proclaimed that the Sputniks are here. That was a Russian satellite. Anyway, look it up. Other calls and letters were less helpful, though. Notes arrived that contained pages of unintelligible scrawls, condemning the Hermans for their sins and suggesting they had invited these, quote, tricks of Satan. Ministers from all sorts of dubious faiths conducted rituals on the front lawn of the house. One man in a blue serge suit knelt in the yard and prayed for 10 minutes. Then he stood and announced, quote, "Everything is all right. You've been forgiven." You won't be surprised to learn that didn't work. But not all the attempts to help were so bizarre. One visitor came from the Brookhaven National Laboratory and stated that it was possible that there were underground water sources beneath the house that might be creating some kind of freak electrical field. Detective Tozzi examined this idea, but a geological survey ended up ruling it out. He was still working hard to figure out what was happening. The detective's case file grew thicker and thicker, with added notes, observations, research, and facts. One incident he highlighted occurred when he was walking down the basement stairs with Jimmy, and a bronze statue of a horse flew across the basement and hit Detective Tozzi in the leg. He estimated the statue's weight at nearly 100 pounds. He had no idea how it could have moved the way that it did. During the investigation, he had contacted the U.S. Air Force, who checked their flight plans and ruled out sonic booms causing the disturbances. He also ruled out radio waves by contacting RCA. The Long Island Lighting Company set up an oscilloscope in the basement but detected no underground vibrations. Building inspectors pronounced the house structurally sound. The Seaford Fire Department even inspected a well on the property to see if changes in the water level were causing the disturbances. They weren't. The detective excitedly read one letter from a Massachusetts woman who had experienced odd events in her living room, like moving furniture. She didn't have a ghost in her house, but rather a heavy downdraft through her fireplace. When she had the chimney capped with a rotary metal turbine, the moving tables and chairs ceased to move. Mr. Herman immediately had one installed on his own chimney, convinced this might be the answer. But it wasn't. No sooner had the installation been completed than another porcelain figure launched itself off a table and flew 12 feet across the room. New York area television audiences were shown the damage it did to the wall. Activity increased on February 20th. Another decorative figure flew through the air and shattered. A bottle of ink popped its screw-on cap, sailed into the air, and splashed ink across the wall. A sugar bowl flew off the table right in front of Detective Tozzi. Needing a break, the Herman family spent the night with a relative, but Tozzi stayed at the house, and the rest of the night passed without incident. When the family returned the next evening, the sugar bowl again flew from the table, and this time, it shattered into pieces. On February 24, Detective Tozzi was startled by the sound of a loud noise coming from Jimmy's bedroom. The room was empty, and yet a large bookcase had managed to tip over. The next night, Jimmy was in his room doing homework when his record player lifted and moved 15 feet. A small statue of the Virgin Mary flew more than 12 feet and struck a mirror frame in the master bedroom. A bookcase filled with encyclopedias was upended. A heavy centerpiece from the dining room table flew up and struck a cupboard. A globe that had been in Jimmy's room flew down a hallway and almost struck Detective Tozzi. A visiting newspaper photographer witnessed his flashbulbs lift off a table and fly against a nearby wall. Detective Tozzi was concerned about this escalation in violence. What had started as just popping bottle tops now seemed to be becoming dangerous. And he wasn't the only one concerned. A group of scientists from the parapsychology laboratory at Duke University in North Carolina had been following the events reported at the Herman House. These researchers, under the leadership of Dr. J.B. Rhine, had already compiled a mass of evidence that supported the idea that certain people, under the right circumstances, could influence the behavior of objects without touching them. They called it psychokinesis, or PK, and surmised this might be what was happening in the Popper case. At the same time the disturbances were increasing, Dr. Ryan's assistant, Dr. J. Gaither Pratt, traveled to New York, arriving at the Herman House on February 26th. Pratt believed that someone in the house was unknowingly causing the strange incidents to occur. They'd been studying cases about similar happenings and noted that in most cases, there was an adolescent child who was present, usually around the age of puberty, who manifested these PK abilities. They were, however, unaware that he or she was unconsciously causing the events to happen. According to Detective Tozzi's notes, it was soon apparent that Jimmy was at or near the scene of the disturbances in the house more than 75% of the time. He was often the only witness to what happened. However, the detective had cleared the boy of deliberately causing any of the disturbances. Dr. Pratt was welcomed into the Herman House, explaining he was there only to observe. He spent most of his time with Jimmy, chatting, playing cards, helping him with his homework, and nothing unusual happened during his visit. So Dr. Pratt then summoned another colleague from North Carolina, Dr. William Roll. Together, they interviewed the family members and were convinced they hadn't been faking anything. As he told a United Press reporter, quote, "The family was much too shaken for it to be a colossal hoax." Things were quiet for several days, and then on March 2nd, a dish flew from a kitchen cabinet and shattered on the floor. This was followed by a small table that flipped over in Jimmy's room. A bowl of flour slid across the dining room table and jumped into the air. A bookcase tumbled over in the basement. A few days later, Popper was back. Mr. Herman was away on business, but the rest of the family was home and getting ready for bed when Dr. Pratt and Dr. Roll heard a loud popping sound in the basement. They hurried downstairs and found that the lid had popped off a bleach bottle that was sitting in a cardboard box. And that was it. This was the last happening that occurred at the Herman house. Detective Tozzi had recorded 67 disturbances in the home over the course of the last month. The house had been visited by police officers, building inspectors, electricians, plumbers, firemen, parapsychologists, and what seemed to be half the nutcases on the East Coast. And yet none of them had been able to present a satisfactory explanation for what had occurred. Weeks after the household returned to normal, experts still came to investigate and to theorize about what had taken place. But by then, the Hermans were done. They just wanted their lives to get back to normal. They no longer cared why the disturbances had taken place. They were just happy they were over. Mrs. Herman told an Associated Press reporter, quote, "I don't think there is a definite solution. It's just one of those things with no rhyme or reason to it. But there was definitely a physical force behind it." It's easy to see how the unexplained events in an ordinary family's home could have inspired at least some of the elements that went into the writing of Poltergeist. But what about the more horrific elements of the film? The ones that seem to suggest why the Freeling house became haunted in the first place? That was the plot twist that revealed the bodies from the cemetery that had been located on the property were never moved, simply built over. Now, believe it or not, this isn't as uncommon as you might think. Old cemeteries become lost when records disappear, or they're forgotten, or someone is just too lazy to do the work that's needed to make sure that all the bodies have been moved. And it's not uncommon when the houses built on top of those graveyards become haunted. But it was a story that made the news in Texas at the same time the script for Poltergeist was being written that I believe directly inspired the film's final twist. That story was first reported in early 1981 when Ben and Jean Williams moved out of their brand new house on Poppets Way in a subdivision in Crosby, Texas. And they weren't the only ones that moved. Soon, seven of the eight families who lived close to them in the development also moved away. They said they left because of the ghosts. Well, shortly after Ben and Jean moved into their house, they noticed something odd about the place. At first, it was an oppressive feeling, but soon it was other things too. They were all little things, but when combined, they formed a bigger, more terrifying picture for the couple. Hundreds of ants began invading the house, followed by snakes that acted uncharacteristically hostile. Plants died for no reason, and pets began acting strangely. And then there were the sinkholes that began to appear in the yard. The sinkholes were forming near an oak tree in the yard that had some peculiar markings on it, and the holes kept getting bigger. Even when dirt was added to them, they refused to fill. No one noticed at the time how eerily the holes looked like open graves. Then more mysterious and frightening events began to occur. The toilets in the house flushed on their own. Lights turned on and off without explanation. The garage door started opening and closing itself. Ben and Jean separately heard footsteps pacing back and forth through the house. Both assumed it was the other, but when they went to check, they found no one there. Tapping and knocking sounds were sometimes heard by not only Ben and Jean, but by neighbors and visitors to the house. Several people reported seeing shadowy shapes and figures that looked like people in the yard. If the couple didn't know better, they'd think their house was haunted. But they didn't see how it could be. The house was brand new, completed just weeks before they moved in. There was no strange history associated with the house, and certainly no one had died in it. But what Ben and Jean and other families in the neighborhood were about to discover was that the subdivision had a secret When a neighbor named Sam Haney contracted to have a swimming pool built in his backyard, the work came to a stop almost as soon as it started. Workmen had unearthed human remains in his yard, the bodies of a man and a woman. And those two bodies turned out to be just the beginning. It turned out there were dozens of bodies buried under the neighborhood. It was revealed that the subdivision was located on what had been a plantation, once owned by a prominent local family. They'd owned slaves before the Civil War, and one section of the property had been used by the slaves and their descendants as a burial ground they called Black Hope Cemetery. Black Hope Cemetery, if you haven't figured it out already, was located exactly where the Poppets Way subdivision had been built. Ben Williams began looking for information about the cemetery, but there were no records of it. He eventually received help from an older man named Will Freeman, who had helped to bury people at the site when he was young. He explained the graveyard had been disorganized, but they'd always tried to bury the dead on higher ground to avoid rocks and boggy low spots. The homes of the Williams and Haney families, as well as those closest to them, were now located on that higher ground. Freeman also told Ben that no one could afford tombstones in those days, but when he'd buried his two sisters, he said he'd used a nearby oak tree as a makeshift marker. This was the tree with the markings on it that Ben and Jean had discovered in their backyard. Following the discoveries of the body in the yard, Sam Haney filed a lawsuit against the Purcell Corporation, the developers of the subdivision. Ben and Jean were urged to join the expensive suit, but as it dragged on, they were tempted to simply sell their house and move away. However, the attorney told them that if they listed it, they'd have to disclose the fact that it had been built on top of Black Hope Cemetery. So they decided to wait and see what happened with the lawsuit. But it continued to drag on. And in fact, it wouldn't make it into a courtroom until 1987. Well, tired of waiting, Ben and Jean tried to sell the house. Their attorney tried to pressure the title company into leaving the cemetery out of the records, but this just ensnared the property in mountains of red tape and even more legal problems. It all boiled down to the house being impossible to sell, while it was also impossible to prove the graveyard was really on the property since no official record of it existed. The only way to prove it was to dig for more human remains, which was illegal under Texas law. Meanwhile, the strange events in the Williams house continued. The unexplainable noises and spooky incidents kept occurring, and apparitions were spotted both inside and outside the house. The entire family also began to be plagued by nightmares. After a family pet mysteriously died, Jean couldn't stand it anymore. She took a shovel from the garage and went out to the oak tree in the yard that Will Freeman said he'd marked years earlier. She started digging, but later claimed she had only uncovered a few inches of dirt before a terrible, piercing pain stabbed through her back, and she was forced to stop. And then later that afternoon, her daughter, Tina, suddenly died. Tina had been treated for cancer, but it had gone into remission and her health had improved. Her sudden death was completely unexpected and her doctors were unable to explain it. While their nerves shattered, the Williams family fled the house and moved to Hamilton, Montana, where they owned a vacation home. They were convinced that if they stayed in the house in Texas, their lives would be destroyed. In the end, they lost an $18,000 down payment, 7 years of mortgage payments, and ruined their credit rating. But they were glad to be out. In May 1987, the Haney family lost their lawsuit against the Purcell Corporation. The jury initially awarded them $142,000 in damages, but the judge nullified the verdict and left them with nothing. Purcell executives had testified they knew nothing of a graveyard in the area, and the judge ruled that Purcell had not been intentionally negligent, even though rumors had placed the graveyard on the site for years before the development began. The Haneys, along with several other families, also moved out of the neighborhood. Today, the Crosby neighborhood that was built on the old Black Hope graveyard seems peaceful, at least on the surface. The owners of the Haney house say they have never experienced anything weird in their home. A man who lives near the former home of the Williams family claims he's also never experienced anything strange, although his wife said in an interview, quote, "I've never noticed anything out of the ordinary, except the lamp comes on and off without warning. I think maybe it's a circuit problem or something." Another neighbor, Joe Clark, said, quote, "One time my mother, a friend, and I were in the house and the bedroom door slammed shut. I told them it was the draft or just the wind. I don't think it's anything, but to this day, my mother won't stay there past dark." His wife Kim added, quote, "The only thing that ever happened to me over the years is the one time I felt the definite presence of a hand on my shoulder, but there was no one there." Clark's mother, Jan, reported an incident where she and her grandson saw a black shape floating across a room and passing in front of the television set. She said, quote, "I don't tell stories unless they're true. When that door slammed shut, there was no wind, no fan, and the window wasn't open." Jan also said that her three-year-old granddaughter, Taylor, told her mother that a brown man saw her and tried to pick her up. Jan said, quote, "There is something to this. Some people won't talk about it because they don't want to be considered crazy, or they just don't care to know the truth." Another neighbor who also lives nearby reported coming home one night several weeks after moving into her house and finding it strange that both her husband and their dog were looking straight ahead at the television and wouldn't acknowledge her presence. She had to physically touch her husband to get him to look at her. He didn't explain his odd behavior until 2 weeks later. When he did, he told her he'd come home and found the dog cowering in the corner of the living room, shaking and too terrified to move. She added in an interview, quote, "When he went to check on the dog, he bent over to pick up his slippers and they flew from his hands across the room. He said the reason they hadn't looked at me is because they were both still too afraid and too scared to see who'd just come in the room." To this day, more than 40 years after the story of Black Hope Cemetery made the news, and after the release of the movie Poltergeist, that small Texas graveyard has still not been officially acknowledged. The dead still lay restlessly under the earth of that subdivision, perhaps waiting for the day when they'll finally be able to rest in peace. Thanks again for listening to American Hauntings, and we hope you'll stay tuned for the postmortem section of the episode. It's coming right up after these messages from our sponsors.
When Troy and I started this podcast, it seemed like we had to figure it out all on our own. Scripts, setup, recording schedule, logos. I mean, seriously, you've heard all the old seasons. It was super overwhelming, and every day seemed to introduce a new decision that needed an answer. When you're starting off with something new, it seems like your to-do list keeps growing every day with new tasks, and that list can easily begin to overrun your life and maybe even frustrate your podcast co-host. Finding the right tool that not only helps you out, but simplifies everything can be such a game changer. For millions of businesses, that tool is Shopify. Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world and 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, from household names like Mattel and Gymshark to brands just getting started. In fact, Shopify is the tool I use to build the American Hauntings clothing store. Get started with your own design studio. With hundreds of ready-to-use templates, Shopify helps you build a beautiful online store to match your brand's style. Accelerate your content creation. Shopify is packed with helpful AI tools that write product descriptions, page headlines, and even enhance your product photography. Get the word out like you have a marketing team behind you. Easily create email and social media campaigns wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling. And best yet, Shopify is your commerce expert with world-class expertise in everything from managing inventory to international shipping to processing returns and beyond. If you're ready to sell, you're ready for Shopify. Troy, can I get that old school cash register? Yeah. Turn your big business ideas into with Shopify on your side. Sign up for your $1 per month trial and start selling today at shopify.com/hauntings. Go to shopify.com/hauntings. One more time, that's shopify.com/hauntings. Okay, Troy, yeah, can you give me the, can you stop with the, can you stop? Troy, just stop. Okay, no, just give me the cash ready. Troy.
The house looks just like the one next to it, and the one next to that, and the one next to that. A young couple live in it.
Give Ken a kiss.
You are so unlucky!
With their three children.
Of course you have to chew each bite 10 times.
And something more.
Last night, do you remember when you woke up and you
yes.
said you're here?
Uh-huh.
Well, who did you mean? Who's here?
TV
people.
Something's funny going on here next door. Something,
We were wondering if maybe you had experienced any disturbances lately.
What kind of disturbances?
I don't know what hovers over this house.
Spielberg crosses a frightening new threshold into a world within our own. Its form is revealed.
What is it?
Its focus is clear. And the games are over. Poltergeist. It knows what scares you.
Yeah. We're good, so.
Sweet. Well, yeah, man, I'm ready when you are.
Ready for a little more American Hauntings this week? Well, we're back with the American Hauntings podcast, the postmortem after the episode where we dissect this week's show. My name is Troy Taylor, and I'm the guy who narrates and writes the show. And across from me is the guy who keeps asking me to buy him a shovel because he wants to do some digging in his backyard this weekend. It's my friend, producer, sidekick, and co-host, Cody Beck.
Yeah, they can't tell me where I can't build a pool.
You know? Yeah, yeah,
yeah. I don't care if I live in an apartment complex or not.
There you go. Hey,
you I'm know. Doing all the labor aside from, you know, everything after the hole.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, yeah, this is a crazy one that we'll dive into, but at a classic.
Yeah. 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 It is a classic. It's a little different than the ones we've been covering. Thank God. So we can go back to, you know, something that's a little, you know. More believable? I don't know. Something.
Well, I definitely have questions all about that. But before we dive into that, hey, man, it's June now. What do we got going on?
Aside from the obvious? Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. The obvious being the conference at the end of the month, the 27th and 28th in Alton/Godfrey, Illinois. I have to add that because we're at Lewis and Clark College. But we're getting close to the end here, folks. So we really, really love to see you at the conference. If you haven't signed up yet, I mean, it is going to be a couple of days out of your summer that you're going to look back on and say, hey, that was a great weekend. Mm-hmm. So we'd love to see you there. But we can only beg you so much. So just go to ghostconference.net, get signed up so that we will actually see you there. But we do have some other events too. This coming weekend, we do have the Ghosts of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the magic show, both Friday and Saturday night. It's by the same guy who did the Ghostlight Mysteries back in April and May that everybody who came raved about. So we'd love to see you come back. It is a new show, or if you haven't seen it yet, come see it. I think we've still got too many tickets left, in my opinion. As good as this guy is, I think that it should be already packed full, but it's not yet. So it's your chance to still get tickets for that. I will not be there. I will be in Harrisburg, Illinois, Friday and Saturday. I am doing a benefit, a fundraiser for the Harrisburg Library on Friday night. And then on Saturday, I am doing my Ghosts of or Gangsters of Southern Illinois program. Harrisburg being the home of probably the most famous of the gangsters, Charlie Berger. So either his relatives will come and kill me and I'll never be seen again, or they'll have a really good time, like all those Shelton people who have come to some of the dinners when I've presented that event. So nice. I guess we'll hope for the best. Weekend after that, St. Louis Exorcism on Friday the 13th. That is almost full. And we've got limited spots left for the River Road Tour on the 14th. And then on the 21st is my last event before the conference, and that is the American Cults Murder and Mayhem dinner. So if you haven't checked that out yet, come and see it. That one's a lot of fun. Oh, well, fun being that, you know, I guess it depends on your on your outlook on, you know, murder, death, suicide, that kind of thing. But anyway, you can go to dinnerandspirits.com and check that out. As always, our tours in Alton, Springfield, and Decatur are up and running for the summer, and we'll continue on through the fall. But also, I just added last week, just added downtown Alton haunted pub crawls in July and August. I had to add another one today because the July one is already sold out. I mean, we only had it up for less than a week. So we have one on August the 8th and one on August the 22nd. And if those go well, I'm going to consider doing a couple in the fall too. They are going to be a lot of fun. And we're going to do some stuff that we don't normally do on any of the other tours. So that should be a good time. So anyway, that's what I got coming up. So
that's awesome. August 22nd is my birthday. In another lifetime, Troy, I would have been.
Yeah, I know. I understand. So,
yeah, but I want to give a shout out to our new subscribers on Patreon. So thank you very much for supporting the show to Janet and Kate. I hope you're enjoying all the terrible stories.
Listen, the Patreon show, right now we've got season five of our alternate podcast running. It's called Monster, and it is about Albert Fish. And I actually just finished writing the next episode today. And I always warn everybody going in that, you know, these are definitely not for the faint of heart. I could make an entire list of all the things that I need to caution people about, but I figure if they signed up for the Patreon and they know what they're getting, that is not my problem anymore. It is their problem because I warned them ahead of time. And I got to tell you, this next episode might be the worst one so far, as the cringe factor goes. So, we'll see. But anyway, we offer that alternative show. And listen, we got four other seasons that people can binge if they have not signed up for Patreon yet. And we do it every other week. So you get this show 1 week, and then the next week you get one of the Patreon shows. And so you don't have to wait. You get a new show every week. So check it out. It's patreon.com/American Hauntings. And listen, just if you sign up and you think, I'm just going to listen to the podcast, I don't care about any of the rest of the stuff, not the discounts, any of that stuff. It's $5 a month just to get the show. $5. I mean, how do you go wrong? I don't know. I don't understand it. I feel like we're giving stuff away for free practically. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so check it out and get signed up if you think you would. Well, if you think you've got enough nerve to listen to this season. I think the last season was the Ed Gein season. It was a little rough, but this one's definitely worse.
Yes,
definitely. Yes,
100%. Yes, and I have a new listener review I wanted to read. This one comes to us from Rainbow Girl out of Australia, and it is titled Best Podcast Ever. So I love this review, and it's weird. It goes professional, eloquent, well-rehearsed, nope. Hilarious, entertaining, full of information, indeed. Troy and Cody continually bring the goods with the show. I enjoy the fact that even though they are covering places and tales we've heard before, it's not rehashed. There's something new to learn. Troy isn't afraid to debunk supposed ghosts and falsehoods. Meanwhile, Cody represents a majority of us with his questions and often silly puns. This is the part that's a little different. It says, I'm so glad I stumbled upon the show. It's like a warm hug from that peculiar yet fascinating uncle you see once a year.
Oh, okay, that's those are the kind of uncles. Yeah, we are not that uncle.
No.
We may be the weird uncle that tells inappropriate stories at the Thanksgiving table, like when I ask who's your favorite serial killer at the Thanksgiving table. But that kind of gets into the creep factor of uncles. So maybe it's different in Australia. You never know.
Yeah,
so.
Down under. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Anyway, thanks for the review, I guess.
No. I think it's a good review. I think she means well with it.
So. Right. It's still 5 stars. So, hey, we appreciate that.
Yeah, we do. So, we appreciate your reviews. And, post a review and we read it on the show, we'll even send you something cool in the mail. I am all caught up, by the way.
Nice.
So everybody who has contacted me on the haunt line at 217-791-7859 has gotten their cool stuff mailed to them, and I haven't heard any complaints, so hopefully they liked what they got.
Sweet.
A bit of a crapshoot, but hey, who knows. So
all right, you ready to dive in?
I am ready if you're ready.
I'm ready. Yeah. So this movie is a classic. It's a lot of fun.
Which we talked about numerous times before.
We really have.
Yes. Yeah. In different lists and different ways. And so we didn't want to address any of the poltergeist curse stuff.
Yeah.
In this one, we've already talked about that kind of stuff and that's kind of been done to death. So we really wanted to get into the behind the scenes stuff. So, yeah.
Right. And so something I was wondering about, and I don't think I necessarily asked this question before because I didn't have all the backstory on where a lot of this came from. So there seemed to be so many things going on, seen by so many people. And who really knows? But I wanted to know, do you think stuff like this, going off of assuming that a lot of this stuff happened, a lot of the poltergeist activity, do you think a lot of stuff like this still does actually happen, but it gets so lost in all the noise of all the bullshit that people say?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think so, because, you know, if you go back and I have done it quite a bit, and then I really didn't stay up on it, but I used to just constantly dig for poltergeist stories from old magazines, old newspaper accounts, anything I could find. And I've compiled a lot of them. And I mean, they're all very similar kinds of stories. The pop or the poltergeist story that we talked about in this episode seems to be somewhat common. I mean, this one was a little different, but normally it's, you know, things moving around and stuff, and then they notify some authority or a reporter or something, and they come and they document this. And I had lots of them. And it seemed like from the 40s through maybe the 70s were ones I were finding a lot. It seemed to be, I mean, they happened no rhyme or reason all over the country. I mean, I wrote just, you know, little short pieces, short articles over and over and over again about these different cases. And so these days, I think it seems tame in a way. I mean, something like this happening is not nearly as exciting as, you know, some of the things that supposedly happened that were turned into, like, you know, Conjuring movies and stuff, you know. So I think that they sort of get downplayed. I think this stuff does still happen. I just don't think that with the constant news that we have going on, it's not the kind of stuff that news stations, I can remember, I mean, back even when I was in high school in the 80s, you know, you would write at Halloween time, the newspapers, TV stations, whoever would always run stories like this. Mm-hmm. You know, just because it's around Halloween. And I don't really see that happening much anymore. I think that we've gotten so jaded over these constant TV shows of, you know, oh, here's a haunted place. You know, here's 10 different TV shows on every week about haunted places people go to or weird things that are supposed to happen or going to somebody's house or whatever, that now it just kind of seems run of the mill. And if you don't have, you know, demons coming out of the woodwork in your house, no one seems to care anymore. And that's too bad, because this stuff I find to be much more believable than most of the stuff I see on TV shows. So
nope, absolutely. And that's something I was thinking about. You know, they brought in Duke University and everything. And I
when that's another thing too, is there is no, I mean, Duke University, the parapsychology lab doesn't exist anymore, just like the one out in LA. I mean, and we'll talk more about that one in an upcoming episode, but those don't exist anymore. That's not something that's studied in colleges for the most part. I think there are probably some isolated ones out there, but it's not as common as it used to be. Now it's the, you know, it's the amateur people who are doing it, you know, the civilians, I guess, better than amateur. I mean, because some of them, people seem to know what they're doing. And so you find that it has fallen to the civilians to investigate this stuff. And even some of the stuff that was like Dr. Rhine's records and things, you know, moved over to like private institutes and things like that, where it's just not like it used to be, you know? And so it doesn't have the, I guess, the scholarly, the academic, you know, reputation that it had back at this time, when you would hear more about this kind of stuff, when guys were actual scientists were going out and studying these things.
And I mean, you pretty much said what I was going to say. Is I know I've rallied against the parapsychology stuff in the past, but I do still believe that there should be some scientific method of people going out testing a lot of things, because, you know, who knows? And
and this is the kind of stuff that you can test. I mean, I suppose you can test like ESP. You know, we've seen the beginning of Ghostbusters. We know how it works with the cards and everything. But that kind of stuff you can test. But these kinds of, you know, poltergeist outbreaks are things that can be tested in a way that like ghosts necessarily can't be, because you can't get a ghost to perform on command. Sure. But if you set up in a location like this, where this activity is going on, and you could document it happening over and over again, that's some substantial evidence. Yeah. Where, you know, just, you know, claiming that your Raggedy Ann doll is haunted by a demon is not necessarily anything that can be proven.
Right.
And for a variety of reasons.
And so, when you have, you know, 67 upwards of that, you know, recorded incidents, and they do things like geological surveys. And
sure. Right.
And things
right.
like that. That's how this stuff should be investigated. And I love it. And, you know, love to be a part of it someday.
Yeah. Well, and that's like, you know, just completely off the topic and not, well, it's off the poltergeist topic. There's a story that I've actually tried to document as much as I possibly can. It comes from Illinois in the 40s, about this girl who was staying with her uncle, and fires kept starting in their home and their barn. And they had the Air Force there, they had insurance people, they had firefighters, they had everybody there documenting these fires that were suddenly just appearing, you know, on the wall, on the floor, burning up clothes and carpets. Fires were starting on the ceiling, and all these people were seeing it. You know, they were documenting all this stuff. And then, of course, eventually, when they couldn't figure out how it was happening, they just said, oh, it must be this little girl throwing matches and starting a fire, despite the fact there'd be like 50 people watching her. And there, she was not, I mean, I don't know how you start a fire on the ceiling by throwing a match at it. But anyway, you know, and so that's another one of those stories that was really heavily documented. Now, would that happen now? Doubtful. Mm-hmm. I doubt it. I really do. Plus, these days, it'd be a lot easier to fake that stuff too.
Yeah.
I mean, the things that like happened in this Long Island, you know, case, I mean, a lot of this stuff you could easily set up and, you know, film it with your iPhone and make anything happen, as we've both seen.
Yeah.
People have done on, you know, online, claiming that it's a ghost or whatever, you know. Times are different. Definitely.
Absolutely. With this Texas story and the neighborhood, the Poppets Way, they had to have found bodies when they were just making houses, right?
Well, you would think so. Yeah, you would think so. You know, that whole thing is, and that's where we get into a different kind of story mm-hmm. from the first story. It's not really like the poltergeist story from the first one, but I think it really has a lot to do with this case or with the movie behind the movie.
Sure, sure.
Because, you know, it, on one hand, you've got the movie and you've got all these things happening that are a lot like that first case. And then in the second one, the idea is, you know, the whole thing's buried on a or built on a graveyard. Mm-hmm. So you've got like two very different kinds of hauntings all twisted into one movie, which, of course, is why it's a movie and why it's fun and why it's exciting, you know, but you would think when they were building those houses that they would have run across some stuff, especially since, you know, neighborhood gossip had it that everybody knew about the cemetery. It's just that there were no records of it, just because there were no public records. There were a lot of people who knew it was there. And so that, I think, was largely ignored, you know, because somebody had bought a nice piece of ground and it was a perfect place to put in a subdivision. And as long as we don't talk about it, nobody's going to know, I think, is what happened here. That's in my opinion anyway.
Right.
Kind of like in the movie.
Yeah. You know? and we've talked about this, you know, it happens all the time. And we talked about St. Charles, places around here.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, that's one of the main stories I've always told on when I started doing the Haunted Decatur tours back in the early 90s, were all these stories I had dug up, pun intended, about the cemetery on the west side of town. You know, everybody knew it was there and it was even documented, and they did the best they could to move stuff. And I think they really tried. It's just there really were no records. And so I think that they just really did a bad job with it, because they just, I mean, to this day, people still find bones in their yard. And so, you know, so many haunted houses in that neighborhood, you know, and ghost stories and things connected to that cemetery. So, and it wasn't done maliciously. It was just careless, you know. And I think in this case, it's hard to say. I mean, it could have been, you know, a mistake. It could have been careless, but I just find it hard to believe that, you know, when a guy comes out and starts digging a pool and suddenly finds bodies, why no one found them digging the foundations for these houses?
Yes.
I'm going to say I'm pretty sure someone did. Yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we talk about a lot of activity can be stirred up by doing renovations, things like that. So it would make a lot of sense that, you know, disturbing bodies and things like that.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. Even if you leave out the whole, and this what I've always tried to kind of to try to put a, you know, a realistic spin on this. Let's say that, okay, so we look at it and we say, oh, the dead have been disturbed. Ooh, their ghosts come back to haunt it. Okay, let's just put it bluntly and take all that out of it, take all the spooky woo-woo stuff out of it, and say, now you've disturbed the energy of these graves, the physical energy of these bodies, or you've disturbed the physical energy of a house by remodeling it. What's to say that that energy that's been stored in that house that you've just disturbed now reenacts itself in some way, where it shows you an image of someone who used to live there that just sort of got imprinted on that place, or sounds or noises that have just kind of been left behind. And now you've stirred up that energy. It doesn't even have to be like a ghost that you're bothering, that's coming back to, you know, seek revenge because you've disturbed their rest. This could just be a disturbance of energy. And that's, well, maybe not scientific. It's semi-scientific, you know, as close as you could get to science when you're talking about this kind of thing, maybe. So it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, vengeance from beyond the grave to get dramatic. It could just be, you know, just some kind of energy that's gotten messed up. And now you believe that your house is haunted. Although in the case of this place in Texas, it seems to have maybe a little more anger / malevolence behind it, you know, like we've been forgotten and now you've just built on top of us and we're pissed. And then your kid dies. Now, I mean, whether or not that's, you know, that could have just been something that she, you know, these things are happening and that seems like a bad thing. And we lump it all in together. I don't know if that's really connected, but who knows?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you're literally forgetting and building over Black Hope Cemetery.
I could see
being a little upset about
you're that, asking for trouble. Yeah. Yeah. You're asking for trouble. Yeah.
Gosh. Well, yeah. I know we've talked about the movie a whole bunch, and so I won't go into it in too much detail, but I liked it a lot better this time around. I hadn't seen it in a couple of years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, it holds up. It really does. I mean, it's somewhat dated. I mean, some of the stuff is, but you can't help it. It's the early 80s, you know. I mean, it's gonna be dated a bit.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I mean, what a cast. What I mean? I mean, the perfect cast for this movie. You couldn't have found better parents to play these parents than, you know, Craig T. Nelson and Joe Beth Williams. I mean, they're great. All the kids are great. I mean, I really wish that I hope that while I don't really remember seeing him in much else, the kid that Oliver Robbins that played Robbie, mm-hmm. I hope that he invested his earnings in some dental work.
Oh, gosh.
That's my only thing. I feel so bad for that kid. And I'm like, dude, you're immortalized with those teeth.
Yeah,
and I feel bad for him. I hope that maybe he did something about that. So,
because he is
one of the few still alive. So, you know,
yeah,
except for the parents.
I didn't look into that.
No, I didn't either.
I could follow up. But something I didn't really put together before, though, is I see a lot of influence from this movie in Stranger Things and the Upside Down.
Oh, well, yeah, you know? Of course you do. I mean, let's be honest. Stranger Things is just an homage to Stephen King and Steven Spielberg anyway. That's all it is.
Sure.
You know, with their own spin on it. But yeah, definitely the reach here, the other world that,
the door, especially the exit platform and all that around it.
Right.
I was like, I've seen this more recently, though.
Uh huh. Yeah.
Makes a lot of sense.
No, there's some great stuff in this movie. I've rewatched it. Have you watched the sequel or not the sequel, the remake?
I have. Yes.
That was done a few years ago. You want to like it because it's got a good cast. But
yes.
What was the point? There was no point. And then to make it worse, they give away the whole graveyard thing like in the first 20 minutes or so.
Yeah.
It's really early. And it's like, okay, so what's the twist? Oh, there isn't one. Okay.
No.
I mean, I guess they figure, well, everybody knows. Everybody's seen the original. But if you've seen the original, why do you need to watch the remake?
And I think we did.
Listen, I don't hate all remakes. I just don't understand the point of so many of them.
Right.
I don't have the hatred toward them that I have toward prequels.
Yeah.
You know, prequels in general, I hate. But every once in a while, there's a decent one. You know,
that a lot of it is people claiming they want new stuff and then they don't go see new stuff.
I know.
So when they remake stuff, people go see it. And then it's
I know. It is.
But I know we've talked about the movie a lot. Is there anything else you want to talk about with these stories? I know there is a lot more we could talk about, but I think we've hit a couple key points.
Well, I mean, yeah, we covered it. I mean, I think we covered them pretty well, just telling the story behind it.
Yeah.
And I just think it's some interesting stuff that, you know, they tried to sue, you know, the company, and that stretched out for years. It didn't do any good because, and the people that tried to sell their house, well, they couldn't sell it. Because if they tried to sell it, they're going to have to say, oh, well, we think there are bodies here. But they also couldn't list that because there were no records of bodies there. So they were just stuck, you know, and so they bailed. And yet again, that should say something about the, you know, the truth behind what they were saying. Mm-hmm. You know, they did bail out of this, lost a lot of money. You know, they lost their down payment and all the mortgage payments they'd been making were all that time. And then, you know, and just said, well, whatever, we're just glad to be out of there. But people have moved in. Like I said, people moved in anyway, and they knew. And some people blow it off. And then some people in some more recent interviews have said, well, you know, there was this one time.
The door slammed. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know.
All right. Well, it is now time for our Ghost Rider section. So if you have a question or comment about the world of the macabre, you can email us at AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com. This email comes to us from Kristen and is titled Saint Augustine. Kristen writes, Hey guys, love the podcast. Discovered it a couple months ago, which is surprising considering I love this type of stuff. I'm going to St. Augustine for a friend's 40th birthday and was wondering if there's a ghost tour you would recommend. I have no idea if you know anything about St. Augustine.
Oh gosh, I went on a ghost tour there, but man, dude, that was like 20 years ago. Yeah. I don't even know if who's still around. I'm sure there is one. That's probably, you know, I run into this with other cities too. People will ask me and it's like, I don't know as much about a lot of them as I do about like New Orleans,
right?
Or something. And so my advice is always just check and see. I mean, you can tell by the website that people have, if, you know, it's a fly by night operation or if it's, you know, if there are any reviews, if there are zero reviews for it. There's this company that puts out, they'll put that they're doing tours in cities all over the country, but they're really not. They're just looking to see if they get interest. So if you book it, they'll immediately like refund it or cancel it and maybe not refund you. I've heard both things, just to see if there's any interest in them starting one there. So you want to stay away from stuff like that and check the reviews, because if there are actually tours, there will be reviews. And again, you can't, don't base everything on a review. Look at how many reviews there are and, you know, and see, you know, what they say, kind of the general consensus, because you're always going to have some Karen that's mad about something or, you know, oh, it was too hot. Well, okay, but the tour can't control the weather. And why did you go if it was that hot? You know, and that kind of stuff, you know, logical things. I don't know. If I know, I'm always happy to help people, but I don't know about St. Augustine, but it's a very cool city. And there are some very haunted places there, off the lighthouse to the fort to some neat stuff. So definitely worth going.
Awesome. Yeah. And if any of our listeners, if you've actually been on a tour in St. Augustine in the last 5 years.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Yeah, we'll pass it on. We'll definitely pass that on. So, sweet. In fact, you can send that to the Haunt Line, which is where we're going next. So you if you want to comment about the show, or you got a quick question or you got a quick answer to something that someone has asked, you can text us on the hotline. That number is 217-791-7859. And you'll either get an answer right away or I'll read it on the show or maybe both. But I do have a few from the last time, since our last episode. This one comes to us from the 812. And it says, hey guys, love the theme for this season and Troy's take on the Warrens. I'm wondering if you have seen the movie, the WNUF Halloween special. I've tried to find it and I haven't found it. It's probably on YouTube, which is hard to watch on my TV, but I can usually do it if I have to, but I'm still looking for it. But the movie is is supposed to be a found VHS tape from 1987. This is from continued from the text, where someone has recorded a local news channel's Halloween special of one of their reporters doing a live investigation of a haunted house. The reporter brings in paranormal investigators that are obviously a satirical version of the Warrens. It's a great movie, very creative, and I thought you might enjoy this little stab at the Warren archetype. I am familiar with the movie, but no, I have not seen it yet. But it is on my list to try to track down. But it does kind of remind me of that 92 British film Ghost Watch, which if you haven't seen that, that is more easily available. But it's a BBC show that was done live one time. And they got so many people calling and complaining and freaking out about it that they never ran it again.
Wow.
Because it has a guy who is a, you know, very respected BBC newscaster. He's even in Love Actually. He's doing the interview with Billy when he comes to talk about his Christmas song, if you've seen the movie. Mm-hmm. But that's the guy and he's the host. And so people really thought it was real and it takes place. It's filmed at this supposed haunted house kind of a story a lot like the Enfield horror story that we talked about in some recent episodes. And that's a very good film. That's a lot of fun to watch. And it kind of reminds me of this, but I promise that I will track this this thing down, because I just ran across it the other day, something about it, and I've been wanting to see it. So anyway, this one comes to us from the 309, and it says, "Hey there, longtime listener and recent Patreon member from the Quad Cities. I just started down a rabbit hole about Florence Brennan from Fort Dodge, Iowa. Three of her sons died violent deaths, two by their own hands, allegedly, and one in the hospital after a car accident, and at least one husband who poisoned himself. Allegedly, all four had her as beneficiary in their life insurance policies. Have you written about her in any of your books? No, but I am intrigued. So maybe in a future one of the Hell Hath No Fury books that I do. But said I found the initial articles from 1958, but have hit brick walls trying to find info from her inquest. So I haven't written anything about it, but. I hope that I get a chance to do that, because it sounds interesting. I'll look into it a little bit closer. Now, this one comes to us from a friend of the show, Joe Minecoff from the 636. He says, I love your podcast. We already know this, Joe, and I've been listening since the beginning. Again, we already know. But anyway, I'm giving him a hard time. Your passion for filtering the spooky from the truth is unmatched. That's what keeps you coming back. Well, the reason for the text is not to beat the proverbial dead horse, but my wife and I are wanting to hit NOLA and would love some recommendations. So I told Joe, send me an email and I will send you my list of recommendations. So I wanted to mention that just so that other people who... again, are going to New Orleans, I do have a recommendation sheet, double-sided, illustrated, the whole bit, that I can send you about tours, places, restaurants, bars, you name it.
So I got to get it anyway, on the site.
Yeah, but I do have it. It is available. If you drop me an email, I will send it to you. So this one is coming to us from the 903. And this is Troy and Cody getting caught up on the podcast, the postmortem part of the show. Just like a lot of listeners, I found it on accident, wondering about your thoughts on Robert the Doll. Now, Robert the Doll is the doll from Key West, Florida. He was a doll that belonged to a local artist when he was a boy that was supposedly kind of took on a life of his own. That he had a spirit attached to him. And it became sort of a local legend on the island. Even long after this boy grew up and it wasn't a toy anymore, it was still at his house. So it was a house they called the artist's house. And you could see Robert looking out the window all the time. And he was always kind of this spooky character. He is available to be seen today at the old fort on Key West. If you take, there's a ghost tour on a trolley that's not bad. But if you want to see Robert, that's the best way to see him. They'll take you out there and you can take a look at him. And he is kept in a glass case. And everybody says that you're supposed to ask his permission before you take his picture. But I don't. I never have. I've got lots of pictures of Robert, me with Robert, just Robert by himself. I've never asked his permission, but he is pretty cool. I have a version of Robert here in my office that I keep. I had to buy him from the Historical Society, but he's sitting in a little rocking chair. So, all right, this one comes to us from. This one comes to us from Darius in the 559. He says, "Hey, fellas, love the show. I travel across the country transporting pets and doing rescue transport, and your podcast keeps the long drives highly entertaining." See, I already liked him. That's all I had to hear. Yeah. So, but between stops, I like to check out points of interest based on the episodes. I even once shared your episode on the Villisca Axe Murders with a poor hitchhiker who, when I dropped him off, said, quote, "Young man, you listen to some gruesome stuff."
Nice.
Keep up the awesome work. Hope to see you guys in Alton someday. And Darius works for Paws and Claws Transportation. And then he said, Cody style shameless plug on there. But yes, I don't mind giving you a plug on that, Darius, for Paws and Claws Transportation. But be careful picking up hitchhikers. Have you not seen the movie? I mean, there is the original with, you know, Rutger Hauer from the 80s and C. Thomas Howell. That will be enough to never pick up a hitchhiker once you see that movie. And yes, they did remake it, which was kind of unfortunate, unfortunately, because it has Sean Bean in it. And I really like Sean Bean, but the movie, not so great. Unnecessary remake.
I say pick up more hitchhikers to show our show to more people.
But, well, I know, but I'd like our listeners to stay alive, and picking up hitchhikers may not do that.
Just trying to get these numbers up.
Okay. Well, anyway, this one comes to us from Melissa, Chicagoland to Texas to New York, from the 847 Chicago area code. But this is about the Enfield Haunting episode and your reviewer who talked about Old Town Spring in Texas. I used to live in Woodlands, Texas, right next to Old Town Spring, and I can vouch it's a strange town. I feel like the land is much is more haunted and not so much the buildings. I think it's a place that really wants to be haunted. However, if you go to East Texas, the Excelsior Hotel in Jefferson is very haunted. Now, I have stayed there. I did not have a ghostly experience, but I will say the town is pretty weird. Said I've stayed there several times. The employees do not want it to be known for its haunts, which for me adds credibility, which is true, but it's a weirdly haunted town. But anyway, that is from our friend Melissa. This one comes to us. We're almost done, but I have to read from our listener of the year.
Oh, of course.
Sent us an email. She said, "Hey, Troy and Cody, true story about a fake story. I read a borrowed, tattered copy of In a Dark Place when I was home alone in a thunderstorm, and it scared the bejesus out of me because back then I thought it was true. Believe it or not, that book is always also the reason why mirrors make me uncomfortable, and I've never again had a mirror in my bedroom. Now, it might be made up, but it's still a nice piece of horror writing." That was Ray Garten, he's a pretty good writer. So anyway, that comes to us from Diana, who was, of course, our podcast listener of the year. And our last one, my favorite text that I've gotten over the last 2 weeks. I'm not sure what it's referring to. It could just mean the world in general. It could mean something else about that connected to the business, whether it's our tours or something or whatever, the museum. It could be about the podcast. I really don't know.
All right.
But I'm gonna say it's probably the podcast, but I'm not sure. But it comes to the six from the 618. And it says Ellen here. And the question is, why in God's name do we think we are an evolved species? See, there's a lot of ways it could go when it comes to you and I being an evolved species. For one thing, I've never claimed that I was evolved. I don't think. We definitely have never said the show was. It could be. She also could be referring to Patreon. We could be talking about Albert Fish as well, because I do think this came in right after our last episode of Monster that was put out. So I'm not sure what Ellen means. But the answer to that is, I don't know.
Yeah, we don't have a good answer.
Yeah, but it is my favorite text message that I've gotten in a while. So you'd like to text us on the haunt line, that number again is 217-791-7859. And we'd love to hear from you. So, all right. Well, you ready to wrap this up?
Ready.
All right, man. Thanks again for checking out the story and the postmortem for this week's episode. We hope you love the show, and if you do, we hope you'll share it with your friends, family, strangers, or even people you pick up on the side of the highway.
Yes.
Serious. Come on, man. Anyway, encourage them to listen, and if you get a chance, we hope you'll go to iTunes and leave us a 5-star review, even if you don't listen that way. And if you do leave a review, we'll be reading at least one review during each postmortem, and if we read yours, we'll send you something cool in the mail. Don't forget that as an American Hauntings listener, you can use the discount code podcast for 10% off any books, tours, or events you purchase from our online store, because remember, American Hauntings is more than just this podcast. It's also books, tours, ghost hunts, events, the Haunted America Conference, and the American Oddities Museum in Alton, Illinois. And you can find out everything about us on the website, AmericanHauntings.net.
Beautiful. Well, this episode of the American Hogs podcast.
I was wondering what, if you were going to go ahead and read anything.
It was written and narrated by Troy Taylor. It was produced and edited by me, Cody Beck. To find out more about the show, check out the show notes or go to our website at AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com. If you want to find out more about the podcast, you could reach us via email, by text on the hotline, or on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, probably some other social media spots I don't remember, or maybe us on the side of the road with our thumbs sticking out. Who knows? Thanks again for listening. We could definitely wouldn't do it without you. So until next time, goodbye.
So long.
See
you later.
Since you stalled, I was going to stall. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.